Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
You need to be able to really create that ecosystem where you don't just focus on your existing business model. You need to do that. You need to be good at that. But as a leader, you need to create the conditions for completely new business models to emerge. You need to, you know, symbolically show that the future is important, that the leadership and the most important leadership meetings are spending 40 to 60% of their time with innovation and not just with execution. You need to put in place specific metrics for innovation. You need to give, you know, powerful people in the company the mandate to explore new business models, et cetera, et cetera. So leaders today need to create the conditions for great new ideas, great new business models to emerge, because it's not a talent problem. It's not an idea problem. It's a systems problem. So you need to redesign the system. Sounds crazy difficult. It's actually not. You know, we know all the puzzle pieces. Now it's just leadership commitment. All leaders need to do is step up and invest in the future.
Welcome back. I hope your week's been awesome so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with business and blue sky strategist Paris Cutler, and with Dr. Rick Brinkman, the author of Dealing with People You Can't Stand, then check them out after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Dr. Alex Osterwalder. He's the co-author of Business Model Generation, Value Proposition Design, and The Invincible Company. Alex is an entrepreneur, a speaker, and a business model innovator. He's the co-founder of Strategizer, a SaaS company that helps organizations develop new growth engines, better value propositions, and powerful business models via online applications and facilitated online courses. Alex invented the Business Model Canvas, which is a strategic management tool to visualize, to challenge, and to invent and reinvent business models. Leading organizations and startups around the world use it. He's a frequent keynote speaker at Fortune 500 companies and has held guest lectures in top universities all around the world, including such big names as Wharton, Stanford, and Berkeley. In our discussion today, Alex talked to me about how established companies can change and adapt their business models in uncertain times, like we're having right now with the COVID-19 situation. We talked about why you should always be focused on creating long-term value. And Alex explained how to be more innovative through experimentation if you release the fear of humiliation. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Alex Osterwalder. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Lausanne in Switzerland, Dr. Alex Osterwalder, who is the co-founder of Strategizer and the lead author of the book Business Model Generation, and he's creator of the Business Model Canvas, which is a tool to visualize, to challenge, and to reinvent as well as invent business models. And I've been a big fan of the Business Model Canvas and in particular the Business Model Generation book. So I'm really pleased to have Alex here. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Alex. It's a real privilege.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Hayes, who was our guest on episode 163 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we talk with you, Alex. So big hello to Stephanie.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Now, before we start talking about all things business strategy and business models and reinvention, and I know, you know, you have a new book coming out very soon called The Invincible Company, so I'd like to understand and learn a little bit more about that. But what inspired you to devote your life to innovation and to creating tools to help innovators?
So I was always interested in business and technology and, you know, institutions in society in general. So I was very curious to understand how businesses work. And that's how I did a PhD on business models with Yves Pigneur, who became my co-author and was my PhD supervisor. And, you know, business models back then was a topic that was pretty popular, but it was also a topic that allowed me to kind of dive in, not just into marketing, not just into finance, but understand, you know, how a company is trying to create, deliver, and capture value in a more holistic way. And then starting to work on that, you know, I started to learn also why it's difficult for established organizations to reinvent their business models. So bit by bit, you know, just trying to solve this little puzzle. How can we get established companies and startups to work in a better way? Just, you know, started to become kind of my passion. And then ultimately, you know, the bigger picture here is that I do believe there is, you know, we can help companies become better at what they're doing, create better workplaces, and create happier people. After all, we're spending a lot of our time at work. And, you know, people are, if you look at the stats, 7 out of 10 people are not necessarily engaged at their work. So that's not a good thing. And I think that's because we're not doing everything we can so far to create world-class organizations where it's fun to work, where you can do your best work, and you can have a good time.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And making that connection of the human aspects of both the people working within the company and then the relationship the company has to its clients and its suppliers. Why do you think it's kind of so difficult for many companies to develop a model that encompasses all of that and makes everybody happy and is sustainable and profitable at the same time?
It's a big topic, right? But, you know, I think world-class organizations, they first create value for customers, then they create value for themselves with the business model, and then they create value for their team because that will lead to the other two to a certain extent. And then the fourth one is they need to create value for society because, you know, we want to have a decent place to live. So great companies actually cover all four. Now, that is probably something that is relatively new, that some companies have done this, you know, forever, but that this is becoming a bigger topic is also because people, you know, are more demanding today. Before, people were happy to have a job. Right now, I guess, in the crisis, that is a big topic again. But, you know, people are more demanding of their workplace. So companies have to actually compete for talent. They always had to do this, but I think it's getting stronger and stronger. And if you are a company that can really say, yeah, I'm creating value not just for shareholders and for profits and for growth of the company, but I'm creating value for the society, you will be able to attract more talent. So it's extremely important that leaders shift their thinking. And I do think it's happening, you know. One of my favorite examples is Paul Polman, former CEO of Unilever. So when he started his job, he clearly told shareholders that, you know, the mission is going to be to create value for the company, but also, you know, for society by becoming a sustainable organization. And he told shareholders that you're in it for the long ride with us. You know, we're not going to be able to deliver quarterly reports because that doesn't make sense. It's not about short-term results, it's about long-term results. So he really shifted Unilever to become, you know, an organization that respected the environment, but not at the expense of growth and profits, but in harmony. So I think we're going to see more of that. And just number one, because, you know, the world needs it, the environment needs it. But number two, also because team members are becoming more demanding and they won't join companies with a bad rep anymore. Right now, I think the crisis will probably accelerate some of this, because some companies are not behaving in a very responsible way at the moment. Yes, of course, they need to assure their survival, but it's how you treat people in times of crisis that they will remember. And, you know, even if you have to let go people or, partial work or so, it's how you treat people in your organization that they're going to remember. So beyond the, you know, growth topics, innovation topics, which are already hard enough, I think we need to raise our game in organizations to create the responsible company, because ultimately that will allow us to create more growth and profitability. So it's all connected, right? And that's what makes it so hard. There are many, many different variables that we need to think of. And there are tools now that allow us to do that in a more systematic way.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective and overall perspective. And I think there's some good examples of what you mentioned there around. I mean, you talked about Unilever. I was working for a company back in the 1990s. They talked about the triple bottom line and the five voices, and it was very much along these lines, but there were so many incongruencies in some of the messages coming back. And I was interested to hear that at Unilever they changed the quarterly reporting schedule, because I think there's a lot of short-term versus long-term kind of thinking in some of this stuff, and often it's a little bit, or it appears in the numbers that it's in conflict. So what's your view on that?
You know, so there is truth to that when you are a leader in an organization that is listed on the stock market, there is pressure, right? You do have to figure out how you are going to deliver. But, you know, that now there are numerous examples, and not, you know, like Jeff Bezos for that when it comes to the numbers, when he says, oh, you're interested in our good quarterly results? Well, great. We made them, you know, 5-10 years ago. So showing that the short-term manipulation of the numbers doesn't make a lot of sense. What you really need to focus on is the long-term creation of value, and then the numbers will reflect that. And, you know, one quarter or another, it doesn't really matter. It's overall, are we moving forward as an organization? And that's where the Invincible Company comes in. You know, we need to create organizations that are able to constantly reinvent themselves. They need a portfolio of new initiatives that explore the future. And this is, you know, something that we can now be a lot more systematic about. It's not that companies haven't done this, but a lot of it, I would say, is innovation theater, to use a term, you know, that Steve Blank and Rita McGrath and I use a lot. It's more for the show. We need to make innovation strategic in order for those numbers to actually show up. And that's not by small measures that you do that. You need to create an innovation culture in addition to your execution culture. It doesn't replace your execution culture. It doesn't replace, you know, the good management you might already be doing in your organization. It's in addition. So you need to foster these two cultures under one roof. And as a leader, you know, the number one task already that you should take care of is tearing down the obstacles that are preventing, you know, the innovation talent in your organization to start exploring new ideas. Is rarely a talent problem. It's rarely an idea problem in organizations. I haven't so far met any organization with more than 100 people that didn't have good ideas, that didn't have innovation talent. So it's really more about the structure. So leaders can put this in place in terms of, you know, leadership support, in terms of organizational structures, in terms of innovation practice. This is, you know, now something we've figured out. This is not a black box anymore. Used to be. And it used to be sufficient to kind of, you know, have an ideology. Oh, we're going to do this lean startup thing. We're going to test ideas. Mm. Yeah, but can you show me how you're measuring the reduction of risk and uncertainty, just like we measure, you know, return on investment and execution? So this is getting a lot more professional than it has ever been before. And it's less about, oh, this is now this fuzzy thing. We're going to put up sticky notes and so. No, this is a serious profession that you can learn. It's almost getting boring because it's not the Wild West anymore. You know, innovation metrics looks a lot more like accounting than, you know, the wrong image we have around innovation, which is about the crazy, you know, creative genius that comes up with the perfect idea. That is a completely outdated model. And then the other point, I think, you know, that we're still seeing is there are a lot of innovation myths. A lot of companies think that if they're investing in research and development, or they're just spending enough time with technology, innovation will happen. Well, innovation and R&D are not the same thing. So innovation is about value creation for customers and value creation for your business, which sounds very trivial, but it's actually not. It's about taking a market opportunity, about taking a technology opportunity and turning that into real value for customers and your organization. And in many cases, it doesn't have to be based on technology. That's another myth. I mean, there are a couple of innovation myths there that you need to do technology to innovate and create new value. Take the Nintendo Wii. It's actually quite the contrary. When Nintendo launched the game console, the Wii, it was technology-wise an inferior platform. But they had a completely different business model than their competitors because they were targeting casual gamers with a game console that was controlled by motion control with very fun and simple games, very accessible. So with an inferior technology, they conquered a larger market, and because the technology was inferior to competitors, it was also a lot cheaper. So larger market, more profitability. And that's the contrary often of what we think innovation is. We think, oh, we need to come up with crazy new technologies, artificial intelligence or so. It's absolutely not the case. So I think we need to destroy these innovation myths in order to create organizations that can, you know, really innovate and then deliver the numbers. I think I did a big round tour from the question you started with.
Yeah, no, I think that was really wonderful. And I think what it raises for me is the whole idea that innovation is not just technology, which I know you're very strong on and very passionate about, but that it's actually matching a solution to a real need and to the right market and right audience, and then executing that efficiently. So that all of that is kind of innovation. It's almost like it encompasses the whole business.
Yeah, and I'm not saying, you know, we don't need technology innovation. I think technology innovation is a great thing, but it's a small subset, right, of the innovation field. And it may or may not, you know, power a completely new innovation, new value proposition, or new business model. So the you know, the whole opportunity space is a lot larger than technology. And, you know, as we've seen with Nintendo, sometimes, you know, off-the-shelf technology can be a wonderful opportunity if you just figure out the right opportunities, value propositions, and the right business models. So I think there's we call this business R&D. There is an underinvestment in researching and experimenting with value propositions and business models. So I'm not arguing you want to kill R&D if you have some. Some industries have less, like finance, slowly changing. But if you're in pharma, you have very strong research and development around molecules, but you have a very, very weak, you know, capability to come up with new value propositions and new business models. So we work at Strategize with a lot of pharmaceutical companies, and their biggest struggle now is to figure out how do we come up with new value propositions and business models, because they have to. The world has changed so dramatically, and their technology research is changing so dramatically that they have to come up with new value propositions and business models, new, you know, ways to capture value. I'll give you a simple example. Imagine if you're a pharmaceutical company and you come up with a one injection cure. And, you know, we all hope that we will find a solution to the COVID-19 crisis, right? But imagine you do that for a field where you, as a pharmaceutical company, you've been selling, you know, a drug over decades, so you can keep patients alive, and all of a sudden you have an overnight cure where one injection will cure the patient. Well, guess what? You've just killed your entire revenue stream. So if you don't figure out a new business model and a new pricing mechanism, you're going to commit innovation suicide. And it's actually, there's an equivalent example in history. It's Kodak.
Well, I was just going to say.
They invented the digital camera. Imagine that, right? Now, here's the problem. The digital camera killed their business model, which was about earning money from analog film. So you could argue the technology innovation they did was innovation suicide because it killed their established business model. And here's the thing. Other organizations, if you take Fujifilm, they were able to survive because they shifted their business model portfolio. So the big game, the big new game that we describe in our new book, The Invincible Company, is all about constant reinvention, not just about technologies, but how do you create a business model portfolio that will equip you for the future and that will protect you from disruption. It creates resilience in the system. And that's something we're seeing right now. A lot of companies, you know, don't have a lot of resilience now in the crisis. Now, nobody can be prepared for such a crazy scenario that, you know, happens, you know, once in a century, maybe even, you know, less than once in a century. But you can be more or less prepared. So companies that are good at exploration, they're dealing better with this crisis than companies that were purely focused on execution and cost cutting like Boeing. You don't cost cut yourself into the future. That's a short-term measure. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's not enough to survive for another 10, you know, 50 or 100 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd like to move on to, you know, what we're facing with the current situation and COVID-19, and also to talk a lot more about the Invincible Company. But I'll just make a comment, and I've got a question around the Kodak example, because that happened while I was in the photographic industry working for ACFA in research. And I lived through that change. And of course, at ACFA, whilst they didn't invent the digital photography, they when Sony first came out with the first consumer digital camera, they were at first in panic stations because I guess they realized that their business model was under severe threat. But then after looking at the state of that technology as it was then and realizing that it wasn't really a quality match for film photography, they decided that they were safe. There were a few of us young guys in the company there that pointed out that it was probably going to get better and probably very quickly too. But unfortunately, they chose to focus on film, and also Kodak, of course, focused on film. And I think it took Fuji a long time to also change their model. So we all know what happened. But I guess the question I have is, from a Kodak point of view of developing that digital photography, what should a company do in terms of new developments that kind of fundamentally are a service to their clients, right? Because Kodak thought they were in business to produce film and photographic paper for photographers, but what they're actually in business doing was helping people capture memories, and digital photography is another way to do that, and as it turns out, a much more convenient way. So should a company be looking at it from that perspective and developing things, and how do they manage that, making their current business model redundant?
So I think one of the challenges, and we're seeing that very strongly today, is that companies classify themselves in an industry. And that comes from, you know, industry analysis, Porter's Five Forces, and so. And that is usually the death penalty almost for more substantial innovation. So what you really want to do is transcend industry boundaries and just think about value creation and, you know, what's the right business model to create value for different sets of customers. And Rita McGrath calls this arenas. And basically what that means is, you know, you create a portfolio of business models, some that you're managing today and that work really well today, but you also need to open up to a portfolio of exploration of where the business could go tomorrow. And what's extremely important is that that exploration has autonomy, independence, and strategic intent and strategic importance, because otherwise the exploration is always going to get killed by the execution arm of the company, because business units are always going to be able to argue, well, you're giving, you know, 10 million, 50 million to the innovation arm. I can deliver much more value to you, you know, in a short time frame of maybe a year or so. But, you know, in a year or so, you don't invent the future. So you need to create two cultures under one roof. And that innovation culture should go beyond, you know, the efficiency innovation and maybe sustaining innovation, which is about protecting your existing business models. You need to do exploration. And a good example of this, so two good examples. One everybody knows, which is Amazon. You know, Amazon Web Services in most companies would have never survived because, you know, Amazon was really big in e-commerce. That was their core business. Yes, they had infrastructure and all that around it. But, you know, then all of a sudden they started exploring a service to other companies. So the stock market and the stock market analysts, you know, they hated it. And they said, you're in e-commerce. Why are you diversifying in this completely new field, et cetera, et cetera? So they got hammered on that. However, Jeff Bezos continued to invest in this because they had evidence that, you know, this was on a good path. And today it's the most profitable part of the Amazon empire. But now think of it back to the industry analysis thing. You can't classify Amazon as belonging to a specific industry. Are they in e-commerce or are they in IT infrastructure for global corporations? Well, they're in both. But here's the interesting thing. Old school conglomerates didn't have a strong synergy between the different parts. This, you could argue, Amazon is a new school conglomerate that has very strong synergies in the business model because the e-commerce arm or the business and the infrastructure business actually use the same infrastructure, the same capabilities, right? The same resources and activities. So now you have a business model that is branching out into completely different industries. So the business model is actually the unit of analysis. And what you have in most companies is that they still don't understand business models and they see themselves in an industry and they, you know, follow one particular business model that happened to dominate that industry for decades or for centuries. And they're going to die with it because all they're doing is efficiency innovation to improve a dying business model. So I call that, you know, dying more efficiently with a dying business model. And now here's what's very hard. You need to be able to really create that ecosystem where you don't just focus on your existing business model. You need to do that. You need to be good at that. But as a leader, you need to create the conditions for completely new business models to emerge. You need to, you know, symbolically show that the future is important, that the leadership and the most important leadership meetings are spending 40 to 60% of their time with innovation and not just with execution. You need to put in place specific metrics for innovation. You need to give, you know, powerful people in the company the mandate to explore new business models, et cetera, et cetera. So leaders today need to create the conditions for great new ideas, great new business models to emerge because it's not a talent problem. It's not an idea problem. It's a systems problem. So you need to redesign the system. Sounds crazy difficult. It's actually not. You know, we know all the pieces. Now it's just leadership commitment. All leaders need to do is step up and invest in the future. And I'm not seeing enough of that yet. I see some. Amazon, definitely a case. My favorite example today is Ping An, a finance conglomerate that moved from, you know, doing banking and insurance to becoming a technology company that's active in different arenas like the health sector. They've really made this shift. And I would love to see more companies that make that shift.
You mentioned that it's not that difficult. And I think in hindsight, if you look back on particularly the Amazon example, I'm not familiar with the Ping An one. The Amazon example, it makes perfect sense because they developed the infrastructure to support their e-commerce business. They developed all the computing power because it made sense for their own business. And then they realized, hang on, there's other companies that need this sort of infrastructure, but are not going to build it for themselves. So we can sell them the infrastructure because that way we can scale our own infrastructure much more quickly. And also it becomes another business. And I think, another example for me in a similar vein would be Tesla, the car company that's kind of done a lot of work on batteries because that was one of the challenges with cars, you know, getting longer range, having better batteries, and now they're branching out into batteries for solar power generation and storage.
I think it's a good example, you know, if you take Tesla, because one of the things that insurgents don't have is the legacy business model, right? So they can relentlessly disrupt the industry. If Tesla hadn't happened, if Elon Musk hadn't found, you know, taken over Tesla, because he was not the founder after all.
Yeah.
He was one of the early investors. But if Tesla hadn't happened, the car industry probably would still kind of be in the same state, and the electric vehicle industry would still be a very small niche industry. That's my assumption, you know, if Tesla hadn't happened. Mm. Now, you need these disruptors often, but I do believe that if companies, you know, kind of get their act together, establish players, and they build these innovation ecosystems internally, they're almost better equipped than the startups coming into the field. It's just that today, they're not empowering the innovators in their organizations to create the disruptive new business models. So I do believe that once established companies start to put in place that ecosystem and have the same similar logic also in terms of investment, they don't make big bets, but they make many small bets, and they increase the bets on those projects and ideas that show evidence. If they start to build that, then we will see results. And I'm actually seeing that in some companies. A public example that I can talk about is Bosch, the German engineering company, huge company, over 400,000 people. They invested over 3 years in 169 projects. But here's the thing. Only small amounts of money, 130,000 euro to start with, and they give these teams 3 months. After 3 months, they stop 70% of the projects and they only do follow-up investments in 30%. Why do they do that? Because they know that not every project is exploring an idea worth exploring. But you can't know at the early stages what a good project or a bad project is. You need the team to start providing the evidence, not a nicer slide deck, not a nicer PowerPoint presentation, and not a nicer spreadsheet, but real evidence from the market that there is an opportunity. Then those 30% that continue, you give them 6 months and maybe 300,000 euro. And then again, after 6 months, you weed out the 70% of teams that don't bring enough evidence to the table. That is exactly how the venture capital industry works. And that is what Bosch, or if you take another German company, Bayer, are now starting to build internally. And it's not small investments because they want a small return. It's because that's how you get the big returns. Venture capital knows that not every investment they make is going to be a winner. Actually, the ratio in early stage investments is that only one out of 250 early stage investments is going to be a big winner, an outlier. So that's the kind of ratio we need to put in place. But that's very different from the execution logic. Oh, I'm going to build a new factory here, 100 million, 500 million. You need to succeed, right? That big investments to build that factory and to have a big return. That's okay in execution. In innovation, you want the big return. You actually need to start with many small projects that go at lightning speed so you have the winner that emerges. Two very different systems that you need to manage under the same roof. And, you know, I said it's not that hard before. Well, it's not that hard because we know how it works. To put it in place requires a lot of courage from the leadership and a lot of stamina, but the pieces are there. It's not a black box. It's not a risky bet anymore to make that investment because we know how it works. And that's where companies like Ping An are very interesting, because they went through this transformation in 7 years. Amazon, you know, always had this startup culture. Ping An became a, you know, financial conglomerate, but they shifted towards becoming a tech company because they built an entire ecosystem that allowed teams to fail a lot until they would find the winners. In innovation, you actually need to systematize failure in order to find the winners. And that's where Jeff Bezos likes to say that Amazon is the best place in the world to fail, because they do a lot of experiments. They have thousands of experiments running at the same time. Now, in execution, they don't fail. When they run a warehouse, they run a warehouse really well. But in innovation, they fail all the time until the winners emerge. And Amazon Web Services is one of those winners. But that winner pays all of the failed projects by far. So that's the kind of logic leaders need to put in place. And, you know, one small piece here just to illustrate it. I was with one of the biggest European financial institutions recently before the crisis, talking to the CEOs there. And, you know, there's still a lot of innovation myths. Leadership doesn't yet necessarily fully understand how innovation works, because they don't live innovation. They live in the execution engine. So they take the rules from there and they try to apply it to innovation. But it's actually very different. You need to create almost like an internal Silicon Valley besides your world-class execution engine. One doesn't replace the other. They need to live in harmony. Good news is it's not a black box anymore.
Yeah. No, that's a really valid point. And I remember being in some situations in the corporate world where there was an innovation project, but then we'd have people pulled off that project to go to do some other things, and they would fall into what you describe as execution. And so there was always a lack of resources, but the other thing also was the culture was always a bit off. So people would have this execution mindset when they were developing the innovation thing, and certainly the fear of failure was really big. So they can't have that in the innovation department.
Imagine what you just said, right? If a venture capital, you know, firm called the startup they invested in and said, "Hey guys, you know, I need, you know, that you remember the last round we did the 1 million? I need you to wire 500,000 of those 1 million to my other startup," you know? That's just unimaginable, right? You can't work like that. But that's what happens in the corporate world all the time. Or you have zombie projects that are still around that should have been killed a long time ago because they're not on path towards becoming a real business. But, you know, nobody has the courage to kill that project, because then somebody will have to admit the failure. In the startup world, it's okay. Actually, venture capital firms don't like investing in first-time entrepreneurs because they have no experience. So if you can show you failed once or twice, you know, it's almost a badge of honor if it's not stupid failure, you know, because you learn from failure. And you know what? Sometimes the timing was wrong. It's okay. The technology was not, you know, ripe enough. That's all okay, because venture capital firms know that not every bet is going to be a winner, and that those companies they invested in that failed are not losers per se. This is something that wasn't quite right yet. And they invest in the same entrepreneurs later on. So Steve Blank's story, you know, Steve Blank, who launched this whole lean startup movement, he has a great story from his own startup career. He had one startup that completely bombed. I think he grilled something like $50 million of the investors' money because they couldn't, you know, get the business model right. The same company invested in his last startup, which, you know, gave them, you know, billion-dollar returns. And you know, at the beginning, he was very surprised that the same investors would invest in him again, you know, after he failed. But that's exactly the thing. You get more experienced over time, and it's not your fault sometimes when you fail. So this is something that we need to embrace 100% in corporations, that in innovation, it's nobody's fault when you fail if you followed the process of testing and adapting. If a project doesn't show evidence, you kill it. Fine. You put the people who are working on that project on the next project. That's exactly how it works at Amazon. Innovation teams that failed don't get fired. They get put on the next project. And guess what? They will do better. It's a different environment. And again, they might fail again. However, you know, over the 100 teams that are exploring, one will get it right, but you can't pick that one team. You need to create a funnel that allows that one team to emerge. And it's a group effort. Without all of those teams that are exploring, you couldn't have that one winner. So what leaders in established companies, small or big, need to understand, it's the same for small and medium-sized companies, is that you can't pick the winner. And if you believe you can, you're delusional, because you're saying you're better than an entire venture capital industry. When it comes to innovation, I'm saying, okay, we're not talking execution.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, yeah, that's fascinating. And I mean, I could go on for ages on that, but I did want to explore the premise of your new book, The Invincible Company. I'm sure there's a lot of these ideas that are carried into that, but there's some other examples there that I know are there from the summary that I've read. So tell us a little bit about the premise of The Invincible Company.
Yeah, so, you know, the question I often get is, well, Alex, isn't that a bit arrogant to call a book The Invincible Company? And I say, well, you know, no company can be invincible, but you can put in place the mindset and the conditions to stay ahead of others because you constantly reinvent yourself. So invincible companies have three characteristics. The first one is this attitude of day one. You know, they never sit back and say, wow, we're such a great company. You know, we made it. They constantly reinvent themselves while they're successful. Innovation is not, you know, a workshop or at one thing you do, you know, at a certain point in time. It's a continuous activity. That's the first thing, you know, a continuous reinvention, continuous self-disruption. The second aspect is that invincible companies, they compete on superior business models. They don't compete just on technology, product, or price. They build superior business models that give them moats and that outcompete others. And the third characteristic is that they transcend industry boundaries. You can't classify them in one industry. Their business model becomes the unit of analysis. Now, Amazon, we said Amazon Web Services and e-commerce, two completely different industries, but that works because the business model of Amazon is the unit of analysis. Take Apple, you know, they do hardware and that's where they earn money, but they also do software, they also do media, you know, they do laptops, etc. So it's entertainment. So it's the business model, again, the unit of analysis. So that's the core. We show what you need to put in place to become an invincible company. And the ingredients, if you want, the cookbook is that to constantly reinvent yourself, you need a portfolio of business models. You need to manage what you have, your existing businesses, and you need to get better at that. And that's kind of the more the traditional portfolio management. But you need to assess your disruption risk. How likely are you to be disrupted? And in order to fight that disruption risk, you need to create an exploration portfolio. You know, what are you working on today, your innovation funnel, that will assure that you're ready for the future? So you need to manage this dual portfolio. And the core tool we use there is the portfolio map. So just like we had the business model canvas in our first book, here in our fourth book, we have the portfolio map, which is a shared language for leaders to manage their portfolio of businesses, you know, what they have today and their new initiatives. The second big chunk in the book is all around building better business models. What we see from practice in the companies we work with, most of them are still stuck thinking about new segments and new products and maybe with new technologies. Now, that's not wrong, but you need to get better at embedding new technologies and market opportunities in superior business models. So we created a business model pattern library. We have two types of patterns, invent patterns that allow you to design better business models. And we have shift patterns, which allow you to shift from an outmoded business model to a new one. For example, from product to service. For example, from selling stuff to becoming a platform that's hard to disrupt. So this pattern library allows you to deeply understand how to compete on business models, not just product, service, and price or technology. And then the third big chunk of the book is around creating the innovation culture in addition to your execution culture. So we call that exploit, explore, an innovation culture and all you have to put in place to design and manage that culture. And that starts at the leadership level. And, you know, while it sounds trivial that you need leadership support, there's some very, you know, important things you need to put in place, like the portfolio management, like, you know, giving innovation power, et cetera, that's incredibly important. So we really give the blueprint, we give it away, if you want, to all our secrets in what we've seen companies struggling with, and we give them a recipe, a blueprint, a cookbook to actually build the invincible company. Because it's not just about doing a couple of experiments and doing a little bit of lean startup. That's innovation theater. It's about designing a system, the new type of corporation that is world-class at execution and world-class at innovation. And, you know, in our strategizer tradition, it's a very visual book, very playful, very dense. I'll agree with that. But you'll find a lot of things there. And if you want a teaser, you just go to our website. We give away a quarter of the book. You can find 100 pages of the book on the Strategizer website.
Hmm. Okay. Well, yeah, I see that Amazon have scheduled it for release on April 14, which is in 6 days' time as we're recording this. So I'm really looking forward to it because I love the business model canvas and also a couple of the other books that you co-wrote. And I love the whole outline, the diagrams and the very visual nature and a bit of playfulness around it. I think there's a lot of lightheartedness to something that really is a serious topic, but the learnings come out of it really well.
And what we try to do, you know, that what we always ask every time we write a new book is, why does the world need another business book, right? There's so many business books out there, right? So the question is always, why another one? And we only write another book when we created another business tool that addresses an unsolved business problem. And for us, the business model canvas is really, you know, at the project level where you design better business models, either as a startup or as an innovation team or maybe as a business unit. But then, you know, how do you do the testing? That was not yet, you know, the foundation was there, created by Steve Blank and Eric Ries. But we thought, well, this can be even more professional. We need to provide a couple more tools so we can start doing that systematically. So we wrote another book. Because we saw on the market, nothing's there yet that really gives people a library of experiments. And with this last one, what we were really trying to address is the whole, how do you design the whole system? And not just for large corporations, it's a small for small and medium-sized companies, and increasingly for startups, because the shelf life of a business model is very short. So startups, after 3-4 years, they already have to be ready to reinvent themselves. And then what we still saw, you know, despite our other books, that people are not very good yet with designing superior business models. So we created the pattern library. So we really always only write a new book when we believe the market needs it, because we see in the field with the companies we work with that they're still struggling. And when we see that, you know, the books out there, great, great ideas, but they don't necessarily, you know, provide the blueprint at the plumber's level almost, you know, it really, how do I do this? On an ideology level, on a principle level, you know, all of what we talk about has been there, the ambidextrous organization, et cetera. But how do I really do this in my company, small or big? The tools haven't really been there in a very practical and simple way, so I can just take them and start applying them.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a great overview of the book. And as you say, we'll put the link to the Strategizer website in the show notes, and people can download the free extract of the book and learn a little bit more up until April the 16th. Now, one of the things we've touched on a couple of times in the discussion is the current situation of COVID-19, and that's certainly had an impact right across the globe on business everywhere and, of course, on our lives as well. But in terms of business, so people are changing to working more from home and doing remote work and so on. What do you think, when we come through this, what do you think are going to be some of the changes that are kind of accelerated now and that may stick in terms of how we do business?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were all kind of disrupted almost overnight, or at least within a couple of weeks. So I think the exploration mindset will be there a lot more. because everybody got a taste of, you know, uncertainty in what you, the attitude you need to adopt and in times of uncertainty. Obviously, you know, everybody will be happy to go back to a little bit of certainty, and that's what you need. You need stability in an organization. Not everything is exploration. Some of it is management. But I do think, you know, we will have a little bit more awareness about the requirement to do exploration. And then at the end of the day, it's actually not so bad. It's just about getting out of the comfort zone and then dealing with it. And I see a lot of organizations and people dealing with it relatively well. I also see a lot of organizations not dealing with it relatively well, but that's a learning experience. They will come out of that stronger, or they will have to address it in one way or another. So, you know, while it's a very difficult situation for a lot of people, you know, on the human personal health level, in some cases, you know, with family members falling ill, you know, I do think that this is also an opportunity. Because we were disrupted, we will learn from it and we will come out of it stronger. You know, obviously, nobody hopes for such a crazy event, disruptive event with such high costs in terms of human lives. But we also need to look at, okay, once this is over, what comes out of this? What are the good sides that come out of this? And there will be some once we get through the crisis from a health point of view. Once we get through the resulting economic crisis, because that's inevitable in any case, there will be positive things coming out of this. And I do believe that some companies that were, you know, ready for exploration, they will actually use this to hire some of the innovation talent out there. They will use this as a springboard to advance. So we do, again, I don't want to downplay the difficult sides and, you know, the partially horrible sides of the whole crisis, but there are going to be positive things when we come out of this as well. And for me, the most positive is that people will see, many people will see that, you know, disruption on some levels, you know, is not that bad, because at the end of the day, again, you know, if we keep our health, if we keep our families, you know, that's the essential, and we will kind of get back to the basics, and then everything else is a bit more relative. So I like that positive side of what this is going to bring us. But again, I really don't want to downplay the difficult things that come with this crisis, and nobody, you know, is enjoying this for sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely for sure. I guess one of the things for me is, you know, you can kind of sit back and be frustrated, which we all are, about the situation and feel sad for, you know, the pain and suffering and the cost in terms of loss of life. But then on the other hand, as an individual, what is it that I can influence? And some of the things that I can influence are looking after myself and my family, and then looking after my business, and what can I do with my business so we survive, and what can I do to make it stronger for the future? And I think, you know, some of the messages you've given us today in terms of the invincible company and the disruption and disrupting our own business model and making sure that we're always renewing, I think there's some really good messages there for that situation. And I hope that they those kind of habits are taken into the future, even where people have only adopted them because of what's going on right now.
I would add to, you know, that not everybody needs to be an explorer. Not everybody is comfortable with uncertainty, right? And for some, this crisis is a lot harder, you know, just from a psychological and mental perspective than for others, because they have a hard time dealing with uncertainty. So like in organizations, not everybody should be an innovator, just like not everybody should be an executor. And the problem is just that most organizations are geared towards execution. So it's very hard for innovators to survive and thrive. But I think in this particular crisis, I do think that those who are comfortable with uncertainty, those who are comfortable with exploration, need to take care of those who are less comfortable. Yeah. Give them confidence and protect them, right? Because not everybody is made for this type of environment. And that's where, you know, this is a team effort where people who are more comfortable with this or more comfortable with exploring new ideas need to take the others along, and vice versa. So I really believe that, you know, we need, some are more geared towards being an innovator and explorer, some are more geared towards being an executor and a manager, but this needs to live in harmony. It's not a value judgment. It's not that one is better than the other. They're just two different professions, two different mindsets. So it's a team effort. And I think this is what we're seeing now as well, you know, that those who are better equipped to deal with the situation today need to take care of those who are less equipped to deal with the situation today.
Yeah, that's a really good message. And I think we're seeing lots of examples of people reaching out to one another and working together. I think that's a really good message there in terms of play to your strengths and share your skills if you have relevant skills right now.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, Alex. So I think it's a good point now to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. It's designed to help our audience who are they see themselves as innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful short answers that'll inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today.
Great. Let's go for it.
Yeah. So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Don't fear humiliation. I think the number one skill of explorers is to humiliate themselves 100 times until they get it right.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. I've heard, don't fear failure and embrace failure, but the humiliation, yeah, I like that. All right, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think I have relatively fearless when it comes to humiliation. Just continuously, you know, to take the business model generation book, when we started out and I tried to tell people, oh, we're going to make this visual business book, nobody thought it was a good idea. I mean, constantly people were saying that's stupid. And that became the foundation of all of what I'm doing today. And we branched out of that. But, you know, if I had listened to people, you know, we wouldn't have done it. And then we wouldn't be doing this interview today.
Okay. So don't fear humiliation again, right? All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often? And I guess it's probably a lot of the models and maps that you have in the books so far.
I'm obsessed by tools, of course. So I look out for the best tools and so. But it's just constantly believing you can learn from every interaction. Every interaction you have with business people, you know, the stuff you read, the conversations you have, that try to learn, keep that beginner's mindset and learn from every single interaction and almost see it as I'm testing ideas constantly again and again and again. So experimenting relentlessly all the time and seeing every conversation, every interaction as a learning opportunity where you can test your beliefs of the world.
And that is so consistent with your whole philosophy around innovation for companies as well. Mm-hmm. The beginner's mindset and the constant experimentation.
100%, yeah.
All right. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track? Let's say something, and this is probably an execution question, but let's say something's transitioning from that discovery or experimentation phase to the next stage.
Well, guess what? There's a tool for that. it's called the team alignment map. So the team alignment map was developed by a colleague of mine, Stefano Mastro Giacomo. So you can Google it. We're going to publish a book. Strategize, we're going to publish a book on the team alignment map next year. And that helps teams stay aligned when they execute projects. Very, very powerful, because teams get misaligned very quickly.
All right. Well, we'll have to check that one out. I wasn't familiar with that. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
just have the courage to raise above what everybody else does. So, you know, things kind of develop and everybody does the same way because nobody questions if that is the right way or not. So don't hesitate to do it differently because you believe it's not the right way. So very few people, you know, stand out and try something new because they just accept because everybody's doing it, that's the way you should do it. And I don't believe in that. And in particular companies, you know, they first look left and right and they ask, well, nobody's doing that, so why should I? Well, guess what? Being a leader in innovating requires getting out of your comfort zone and trying something that nobody is doing. So question if it's the right thing to do all the time, because just because everybody's doing it doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. It's just a historic artifact often.
Yeah, that's a really great approach. And of course, you have to be prepared to take humiliation.
Back to the beginning, absolutely. And that goes hand in hand, right? So you cannot get innovation without humiliation and failure, right? It doesn't work that way. You won't get it right the first time. And if you feel uncomfortable with that, that's okay. Then just don't go into innovation. You need to be prepared to look stupid 100 times until you look smart. And that's just a skill that you develop over time. And you become fearless because you know ultimately you will kind of get there. And that's extremely important. The ability to get up after failure is a real skill. And because obviously failure is terrible. Nobody loves failure. Nobody goes out and says, "Oh, I'm going to fail. I'm going to love it." No, you don't. But you're going to. You know that it's part of the process. You need to trust the process.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, this has been fabulous, Alex. I really enjoying this. Now, where can people find out more about you, find out about the book, and reach out and maybe even say thank you for what you've shared with us today?
Well, they can go to the Strategizer website. You can even just Google my name and you'll get to Strategizer. We do, you know, technology-enabled services, and we give away a lot of these tools. We give away, you know, parts of our book. So we have a very strong culture of sharing because our business model doesn't live, you know, from selling intellectual property per se. We build technology-enabled services and infrastructure, software, applications, online courses, etc. You can find all of that. And you can just see, you know, you want to get stuff for free. There's a lot there. You want to go a step further. Maybe there's some things you want to purchase. So just have a look in the shop window and see what you're interested in. If you want to stay connected with the ideas, we constantly share that on our blog.
All right. And we'll post links in the show notes to the Strategizer website and the blog and all the books as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, is there what parting bit of advice would you like to leave our listener today?
The first one, of course, don't fear experimentation and failure. But the second one I would say is, you know, try to create better workplaces as well, right? So all of these tools and processes that we try to put in place are not just to create financial growth for organizations, but ultimately they're to create a better workplace with better work practices in order to, you know, to allow people to have more fun at work and more fun in the projects that we do. So we should never lose the fun of all of this. And you can increase the fun by just using all of these tools. So never drop that perspective of at the end of the day, you know, the journey itself is most important, not just the outcome.
So fun, build fun into everything. And certainly your books and the tools, the way you present them, there's a very strong fun element to them, even though they're, you know, obviously very valuable and add a tool that helps companies and businesses develop value as well.
One doesn't exclude the other, right?
Yeah, that's right. And finally, Alex, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
If you didn't have Steve Blank, of course, you know, and he launched the whole lean startup movement with his thinking and, you know, and all my thinking and, you know, my co-author, Pinho's thinking on how we test business models that started all with some conversations with Steve Blank. So definitely, you know, somebody to have. And then, of course, Rita McGrath, which, you know, she's always been a great, fun thinking partner for me as well.
All right. Well, we'll reach out to both Steve and Rita and see if we can get them on for a conversation on the InnovaBuzz podcast in the future as well. So thanks, Alex, for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today on the InnovaBuzz podcast. I've really enjoyed this. I've had a lot of fun. I hope you've had fun. And there's been lots of valuable information there. I'm sure the listener will take a heap of value away from the episode today. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Thanks for having me. This was a fun conversation. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and in-depth conversation with Alex and took something away from his episode. I particularly like the notion of constant reinvention and exploration of the future with a focus on value creation and experimentation without fear of humiliation. I'd love to know what you took away from Alex's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/AlexOsterwalder. That is AlexOsterwalder. All lowercase, or one word, innovabiz.co/AlexOsterwalder. You'll also find links to the Strategizer website there, which contains a lot of free tools, as well as large parts of his books for free. And also the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Alex suggested that we have a conversation with entrepreneur Steve Blank and with innovation expert and author Rita McGrath on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Steve and Rita, keep an eye on your inboxes for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Alex Osterwalder. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where again we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including Andrew Barnes of The 4-Day Week and business and marketing strategist Mariana Norton. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.